Well, good evening. We know your time is valuable. We like to start on time here. Good evening and welcome to the third presentation in this, our 18th series of talks on faraway places with strange-sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with help from our facilities coordinator, taking pictures at the back, Daniel Peach, and our instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Dustin Johnson designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadden Melke. Our speaker tonight is a native of Chicago, but considers herself an adopted Southerner after living in Nashville for 20 years. Growing up, she wanted to be a writer and was influenced by the stories of Sherlock Holmes and Nancy Drew. She attended schools in Illinois and French-speaking Belgium, and her interest in France comes from her paternal grandmother, who immigrated from southern France to Indiana at the turn of the century. She attended Indiana University, from where she received a BA in French and political science, before continuing her studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, receiving an MA and PhD, and spent time in France, consulting rare editions of 17th century French novels at the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. She joined the faculty of Vanderbilt in 1995 and holds joint appointments in the departments of French and Italian and the Center for Biomedical Ethics and Society, and has directed the Vanderbilt in France program on several occasions. She's been the recipient of numerous grants and fellowships, and most recently received a $300,000 grant for research on the ethics of health and everyday flourishing. She's particularly interested in what lessons the history of medicine holds for our times, and her writings on those themes have appeared widely in academic and popular journals. Her first book, Pregnant Fictions, Childbirth and the Fairy Tale in Early Modern France, was published in 2003. Her second book, Bloodwork, A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution, was published by W.W. Norton in 2011 and was selected as the best book of the year by the Times Literary Supplement and was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize in Science and Technology in 2012. Her newest book, also from Norton, published this spring, is City of Light, City of Poison, Murder, Magic, and the First Chief of Police of Paris, has been widely praised and based on 4 years of research in the archives of the Bastille, and is the subject of tonight's talk. Her next research project focuses on medical forensics in 19th century France. She spends part of her time living in her family home in Aix-en-Provence, in France. Please give a warm welcome to Holly Tucker. Holly?
Wow, that was, thank you. That a lot of times I've done these and they'll say, here you go, stand up, I'm Holly. Thank you, Brian Coots, for inviting me and for the WKU Libraries for this great program. I was thrilled to learn that it's been going on for almost two decades, which is really remarkable. So it's a treat to be here and to be so close to home. So I thought what I would do is start out with just reading a quick scene out of the book to give you a sense both of the flavor of the story, the type of writing, and also to introduce you to a couple of really mean people. If one thing we know for sure, I think on the slips that you've been asked to fill out about this event is, like, write down a couple of things that you learned. I really hope that you'll be able to say is that Paris in the 17th century was one heck of a nasty place. So, without further ado, Catherine Voisin often sent her 9-year-old daughter, Marie-Marguerite, into the dangerous Montorgueil neighborhood to run errands. Stepping out of the family's house, the child joined the swirl of activity in the streets outside, a coin clutched tightly in her fist. Errands for her mother required her to hurry, otherwise she would suffer her mother's wrath. She did not know kindness from her mother, who maimed just as easily with a sharp word as she did with a kick or punch. Catherine did both, and often. Marie-Marguerite, frequent Marie-Marguerite, if you prefer, frequently made her way to the largest market in the city, Les Halles, a 10-minute walk south from her home. The same chaos that reigned in the city streets lived here, but with much greater intensity. Fruit and vegetable merchants competed with one another as they hawked their wares to the crush of shoppers who funneled into the market's narrow rows from all parts of the city. Pickpockets and beggars roamed about, nipping a piece of fruit here, a cloak there, while prostitutes rubbed up against male customers to let them know that vegetables were not the only thing for sale. Marie-Marguerite ducked and elbowed her way through the stalls until she found the right vendor. Cages of birds, hens, quail, ducks, and pigeon were stacked several layers high and lined the perimeter of the small space. Some of the animals were sold alive. The days of others were numbered, if the plucked birds hanging from the wooden beams were any indication. The child trotted toward the pigeon cages and scanned the clusters of bobbing heads until she found precisely what her mother wanted, a single white bird. Marie-Marguerite relinquished her coin and rushed home as quickly as she had come, holding the bird protectively under her arm. She did not know what her mother planned to do with it, but whatever it was, it would not be pleasant. Not much of what happened in the family's rundown home ever was. Arriving home, she walked through the darkened entry hall and into the courtyard. Her mother waited there impatiently. Next to her stood an ugly older man wearing a bright red wig and a gray cape. Without a word, the man yanked the pigeon from her arms. In one deft move, he sliced the bird's neck and collected its blood in a glass goblet. When there was nothing left, he tossed the pigeon onto the ground. With a gruff scowl, her mother told her to go, to get out. Marie-Marguerite ran from the courtyard. So this is a scene, this is a nonfiction book that looks at a cabal of really unpleasant people in the 17th century in Paris who were poisoners, witches, and renegade priests. So I think I have your attention. I wanted to just talk a little bit about this story because there are some things, as you know, to cite the cliche, sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction. As I researched the story, I really couldn't believe just how deep this plot of poison and eventually murder went, and how and why it could have gone as far as King Louis XIV, the great Sun King of 17th century France. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about him in a moment. So this is a picture of Marie-Marguerite's mom at the time of the big scandal and chaos of a trial that took place in the late 1670s. And you can see you can tell just how scandalous it is by the skeletons. You've got, you know, dragons. Marguerite's mother was eventually burned alive, and along with her, over 400 people were arrested. They were imprisoned in the Chateau de Vincennes, which is the dungeon of the Vincennes Chateau. Others were also imprisoned in the Bastille. Louis XIV, the Sun King, set up a secret court because it was so dramatic. Everybody wanted to know what was going on. Both people from the lower classes and also the nobles from the upper classes were being arrested. Louis XIV established the secret tribunal. Hundreds, I think over 200 people, were tried in that secret tribunal. Countless others were tortured. And then over 30 people were executed across the classes, but primarily of the lower classes. Just so you believe me, it's nonfiction, I thought I would show some action pictures. Here I'm working with some of my students in our medical library at Vanderbilt. So much of what I did in this book relied on looking at, this is why I'm interested in later forensic practices, so much of what I did for this book really relied on studying how they, in the 17th century, would have determined what poison was, how it was used, and who was victims of poison, who would be the victims of poison. And so here's some medical manuals, but here's the biggest... Oh, there we go. These are the books I worked with. And they're all in manuscript form. They come from the what's called the Archive of the Bastille. They're all of the records that we still have, the extant records of the Bastille prison and other prisons, including the Chateau Vincennes prison, up until the French Revolution. And what happened is the Bastille prison, which of course no longer exists, it was dismantled, as the Bastille was getting bigger and bigger and they were trying more cases, they were using storage areas. They had a courtyard that right up until the French Revolution, what they wanted to do was to create an archive, an enclosed archive. And they had put together plans because what was happening is all of these documents were just overflowing in the Bastille prison. About the time of, toward the end of these trials, they moved close to 2,000 volumes, if not more, of manuscripts. And the documents that I was working with, I worked with about 30 of these volumes, all in manuscript form, and they represent both the interrogation records of the case that would later lead to Marie's mother being tried and executed. So interrogation records, it included documents that were confiscated from the various poisoners and so-called witches and priests' homes. And then what court records we do have, there was a whole bunch of records that were missing that I was able to find. What records we do have, and then also the torture records. Because, as I mentioned, one of the main ways to get more information was through torture practices, and it was really hard to look through these records because they're written in a way that makes it so they feel really like they're living off the page. So there was a a scribe who would basically copy everything that the accused would say. So it'd be, says she didn't do it, screams, my God, stop it, I'm going to die. And those records could be then turned into dialogue, which allowed me in the book to make this true to the record, but then also be able to help us be in the setting at the time. So let's talk a little bit about, I want to back up in this story, because one of the main characters in this book who existed is the first police chief of Paris. He's the one who was responsible for investigating the crimes of Marie Marguerite's mother, as well as the whole cabal of other people who were engaged in this. And he was also the one, as he started to dig, began to realize that it wasn't just in this local neighborhood of Paris, that it was moving all the way to Versailles and the king's palaces. So this would have been early Paris. And Paris was a dirty, nasty, disgusting place in the 17th century. I've had people ask me if I could go back into time, would I go back to Paris the 17th century? And I say, not on your living life. There is no way I would go back. It stunk. Now keep in mind, there was no pavement at the time, right? So all the roads were dirt roads. People were throwing out chamber pots. There were animals roaming. Tallow makers made candles right next to the slaughterhouses. The slaughterhouses were throughout different parts of the city. And on days of butchering, thank you so much. On days of butchering, the mud would actually get churned up with the blood, and then there would be this sort of rust-colored nastiness. And if anybody has ever been to Paris or to other places in France, I used to always be fascinated, and still am. There are these metal bars that often will stick out of sides of buildings, right at about ankle level. And I couldn't quite figure out what they were for until I stepped in dog poop one day in Paris and went, oh! And so these are to scrape your boots off and to scrape your shoes off, because that's all it was mud and muck. Paris was also very violent. In the 17th century, new technologies made it so that firearms, instead of being more rifle length, could actually be shortened and they could be concealed. Also, it was a sign of status to have a sword slash a sort of a thing on your side and then a sword. And Paris was dangerous for those reasons, but it was also especially dangerous because it was dark at night. People were in very close quarters, tempers flared, and you were scared to death at night. So Louis XIV is wondering what he can do with all of this crime. And you can see, for anybody who's been to Paris, there's a bridge. It's called the Pont Neuf, the new bridge. It's actually now the oldest bridge in Paris. The Pont Neuf in the 17th century is a place where you would never want to be. It's where cut purses and pickpockets, as well as prostitutes and people who are stealing wigs and capes. And it was also a place where there were a number of murders. So it just, I mean, every time you try, I would be terrified to be in 17th century Paris. Now, what happened in 1665, it was a huge embarrassment for the city because there were two lieutenants who were responsible for maintaining order in the city. One was the civil lieutenant. One was the criminal lieutenant. Within a few months of each other, both men died either by murder or other suspicious circumstances. The civil lieutenant was murdered in daylight in his own home in 1665. The criminal lieutenant died for very suspicious reasons. People wondered if poison might have been involved, but they couldn't quite be sure. So what the king decides to do is to, this is a gorgeous picture of Louis XIV. And he's a young king. He would be probably in his early 20s at this time. Louis XIV is trying to make a name for himself. This is a time when there's a big battle, a nationalist battle in Europe between the English, the Dutch, the French, and then also the Spanish. And so Louis XIV really wants to make France the center of not just Europe, he wants to make it the center of the world. Hence the reason why he had no problem using the moniker the Sun King, right? And so we know a lot about Louis XIV's endeavors outside of Paris. So Versailles, this extraordinary palace, like none other, is in the process of being built. While it's being, you can see now, this gives you an idea of in the late 1660s, 1670, there's the palace. You can see that the gardens are starting to shape up. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary palace. Louis XIV at that time, while the chateau is being built, is living in Saint-Germain-en-Laye, which is the chateau where he was born, primarily because he didn't want to live in the Louvre. No, that used to be the palace of the kings. Why would you want to live in the Louvre with all of that stink and danger and general grossness all around you? But he wises up. He says to himself, I can't be the king of Europe, the center of Europe, if my very own capital is an embarrassment. So he decides that he needs a chief of police. Interestingly enough, although there was the civil lieutenant and the criminal lieutenant, there was no real police force in Paris until the late 60s, 1670 in Paris, until the late 17th century. Louis XIV decides this has to stop. Policing was done actually by neighborhood folks, by commissioners who were more lawyers. Do we have any lawyers in the group? Sorry. The lawyers, what they were mostly interested in was not fighting crime. They were really interested in reporting the crime after it happened so they could make, when they charge by page. It's really interesting to look at some of the legal complaints because the handwriting's really big. I wonder why they were charging by the page. And so these commissioners were really not interested in cleaning up the city rooting out crime. So Nicolas Larenie falls onto Louis XIV's radar, as we might say anachronistically. He's a really fine, upstanding guy. He is a lawyer from the Bordeaux region, and I really am fascinated by this guy. He wants to do everything right for the king. He believes in France. He believes in the monarchy. He believes in serving the king and turning around Paris, not just for the king's glory, but also turning around Paris for the safety of its citizens. So What he did in the very first year is he cleaned the city up of its mud. He put a pretty hefty mud tax on its residents. He made the residents get up at sunrise with bells chiming, sweeping all the muck out of the street towards the Seine. That would be another thing. I don't like going near the Seine because I think I'm looking at the Parisian here. I think about the thousands of years of muck underneath that. You wouldn't catch me in there. I've seen some people like paddleboarding. Anyway, so he clears out the streets, but then this is a little bit hard to tell. He also tackles the night. If Paris is called the City of Light, I'd always thought it was called the City of Light because of the Enlightenment of the 18th century. I suspect it's called the City of Light because Nicolas de la Reynie was the very first person to put street lights in any city in Europe. Again, also within the year, he made sure that there were something close to 2,500 lanterns dotting each across the city, dotting each street. At sunset, the bells would chime, and there'd be people hoisting up these very large lanterns made of glass and with huge candles that would last into the morning. And it made every difference in the city. But one of the things that he could not have expected, this is a factum, and you can see, it's hard to tell, but you can see what the old books might look like. It's for a factum, so it's a legal report for Dame Marie-Magdalene d'Aubray, the Marquise of Brinvilliers. D'Aubray happens to be the family name of the criminal lieutenant. And his daughter was put on trial for having poisoned her father. We find out, Nicolas Larigny finds out a couple of years after he takes the helm of the police force that there is a poisoner amongst the Parisians, and the daughter had poisoned not only her father but also her two brothers, and she was of nobility, which was shocking to the Parisians, because how could a woman of quality actually go so far as poison her family members? This was the scandal of all scandals. A huge court case, and she was eventually executed. But other weird things happened that the police chief is wondering about. This is the king's sister-in-law, Henrietta Anne, who was very attached to Louis XIV, and Louis XIV was attached to her. In fact, she was his second love of his life. We're going to meet many of his loves of his life. Louis XIV had a lot of lovers. In 1670, Henrietta Anne also died under suspicious circumstances. And there were rumors in the court that she had also been poisoned, perhaps even by her husband, the king's brother. And Louis XIV never could forget that. That the case of Henrietta Anne's death is still, we'll never know if she was actually poisoned, but there will always be a cloud around her death. So let's talk a little bit about Louis XIV, because these women are going to matter in this story before we get back to Marie-Marguerite's mother. Louis XIV was happily married. He had his Spanish wife, Maria Theresa, whom he bedded every... He made her a promise that he would always sleep in her bed at night, and he kept that promise, even if it meant crawling in pretty tired at 4 o'clock in the morning. He also had lots of lovers. His first real mistress was Louise Lavallière, who was a 17-year-old virgin who ended up giving birth to five of his illegitimate children. He got tired of her at about the third child, but kept her on court for a very long time. Louis XIV may get tired of somebody, but he'll keep them around for a long time. Oops. Then there's the Marquise de Montespan. Montespan is a married woman who decides that she's going to make her fame at court. And she makes it very clear that she will become Louis XIV's mistress. Now, Louise Lavallière was very much... She resisted, actually, the courtship and also the affair that she was having with Louis XIV. She eventually fled after about 20 years. She fled the court and went into a convent. And this poor woman, because she was so very religious and so uncomfortable with her with this relationship with the king, it was absolutely unbearable for her. It also was probably unbearable because everybody in court made fun of her because she was apparently flat-chested. If I came across that more times about how flat-chested Louise Lavallière is, and Montespan is not. Like, are we in agreement? Montespan realizes that Louis XIV is willing to chuck his mistresses off at any turn. And that's when things get interesting. We can try, through the records, we can trace different visits by a number of people of the court to the home of Marie's mother, Marie Marguerite's mother. And some of these people were coming in for makeup advice. She knew a lot about poisons. She knew a lot about herbs. She was also a midwife. She was also an abortionist. And so women were going ostensibly for face whitening powders or blush or something. And then we might find out through other records that it was also a front to buy aphrodisiacs. Spanish fly, crushed up beetle, was one of the main ways that one could have a love potion, aphrodisiac. We also find out that Marie Marguerite's mother was in cahoots with some priests who were doing love spells. In fact, we know for sure through the records that poisons and spells were actually cast, distributed, bought, sold in Notre Dame, which is crazy. And then there's also a small church across the river from Notre Dame called Saint Severin. Saint-Severin, and I was able to locate at least four different corroborating accounts that very likely those did indeed occur. So let's go back to Nicolas de la Reynie. Nicolas de la Reynie starts to piece things together. First there's the Marquise of Brinvilliers, then there's Henrietta Anne, and then there are rumors that are starting to come his way through his police force that there are all these noble women. And he can't be sure who it is. He can't be sure how deep it goes. But all we know is that he begins to get very nervous and ask the king's permission to arrest as many people as he needs to arrest to be able to get to the bottom of this. Louis XIV says, do it. No matter what rank, or condition, that means I don't really care where they are in the social pecking order, I want you to arrest them and interrogate them. So he arrests so many people and puts them in the Chateau of Vincennes, which is a really interesting place. It's on the outskirts of Paris. And if you can take a look at the towers, right, this was actually the palace of a medieval king, Charles V, and the main big rooms on the second, third, and fourth floor would have been where the king held his council and where his ministers met. And the turreted areas are very small rooms that would be small offices, if you will, of the notaries and the scribes and the lawyers. One of the towers, I can't remember which one in this picture, was actually an ingenious latrine. So they didn't have any real cells, but they had actually latrines at each floor. And so that way they didn't have to worry about sanitation as much. I had a chance to visit this and to take a tour with the curator of the Chateau Vincennes all the way up to the top chambers, which are not open to the public. And it was actually stunning to see all the graffiti from the Middle Ages, when people inhabited the king's castle, to the 17th and the 18th century, when it was a prison/dungeon. There's another side dungeon which actually housed the Marquis of Sade. And to be able to see all the scribbling, as well as when you look at the higher floors, in the Second World War, Germans were held there and Americans were held there at different times. And so you can see German graffiti as well as English language graffiti that would have come from Americans. It's a fascinating place, and one of the days I was in one of the turrets, and I was just taking really careful notes about where I was and what I was seeing, and I'd mapped out the chateau, the prison, and one of the things that I learned is that I was standing exactly where one of the prisoners had actually killed herself. And I saw that in the archives the next day. I want to move through the rest of the story. The higher ranking people, the nobles, were typically held in the Bastille prison, primarily because of location to Paris, also too because the conditions were strangely better. We always have this idea of the Bastille being this horrible place. But interestingly, in the secret tribunal was in the arsenal, which sat right next to the Bastille. So the secret tribunal, they'd be tried, and then they'd be walked over to the Bastille where they'd be tortured if they had a death sentence. In early French law, people were not tortured before their sentence. They were tortured after their sentence. So the bulk of the tortures that I looked at, I am a nice person, I promise you. Don't be scared of me. Okay, just don't. Especially when I show you this. But the bulk of the tortures that I looked at took place at the Bastille. Now, if you're interested, it's hard to tell. In fact, I'll probably skip through these slides very quickly, seeing that there's people in the back. There are three main methods of torture, and the illustrations of those are in the book. The prime method that they used is a thing called torture boots, brodequins, where they would put steel or metal along each leg, and they would tie it with a very thick rope, leather, or chains. And then the torturer would take a shim, a very large shim, and a mallet, and then drive the mallet into that sort of boot, which would break the person's leg, cause extraordinary pain. In the records that I was working with, it was really horrible because they were pretty much verbatim. Says she didn't poison someone, and then it would just say one line, first corner. I swear to God, please help me. Please God, second quarter. And you could hear actually the voice of the police chief giving orders to torture these people. And so through the book, one of the things that I'm, throughout my research, I was really interested in, I understand, we've got these, you know, witches, abortionists, poisoners, priests, all plotting to kill people, right? And the police chief is getting worried that it's going to the king. I won't say how or when, because that's in the book, but all I'll tell you is one of those lovely ladies that we saw may have had something to do with one of those horrible people that we saw. And so the police chief is really, you know, nervous about protecting his king. And at the end, I wonder, how can somebody who is so upstanding, I really like this guy, how is somebody who's so upstanding could be the one saying first corner, second corner, third corner? Well, the end of the story is the king realizes that things are getting awfully close. And he asked Nicolas de Larigny, the police chief, to give a report about who is guilty and who is not guilty. This is an example of the manuscript, that I was working with. This is specifically of the police chief, and he's trying to look at all of the records, trying to make sense of this, and he is having a horrible time making sense of it. Think about it. He's got all these nasty people who, are they telling the truth? Are they not telling the truth? And this is a draft of a letter he tried to write to the king. And in it, you can see the frustration. You can see, I mean, in some of the pages that I was working with, you could see the crinkling, right, where he might have taken it and thrown it away. In the end, Nicolas Larigny was never really sure what happened. He could not be sure what happened. And he asked the king, you decide. Well, the king decides that he doesn't want this story getting out. So he tells Larigny to take all of the incriminating documents of the people that he liked in court. Now, the people he didn't like in court, good luck to them. The people he liked in court and of his mistresses, and put them under seal, which Larigny does. And those documents, actually, the documents that Larigny put under seal were destroyed by Louis XIV. Some 30 years later, he burned them. And so thank goodness that we have Nicolas de Larigny, the police chief, because he took a careful inventory of what he was putting into those cases. He also described his thoughts on them. And we have all of his drafts to the king, and that was extremely helpful. Without him doing sort of that close inventory, the story would have been impossible to tell. Louis XIV asked Nicolas de la Reynie to put them under seal, and then doesn't know what to do with all of the prisoners he has left who have not been put under trial. So what they try to do is make an inventory of the prisoners, decide which ones they can let loose and which ones they can never, ever put back on the streets of Paris ever again. And in the end, there were about 20 people, about 12 women, and the rest, let's just say 20 people, and I think I can't remember. Mixed, doesn't matter, gender. Some of them, the women, I know we had somebody from Normandy. There, some of them were sent off to a little island just to the north coast of France, where they spent the last of their days basically never speaking again, never having any firewood they suffered terribly. And then the men, many of the men were actually put in the Chateau d'If outside of Marseille, which interestingly enough is the chateau that the Monte Cristo story was told in, and they also died. Louis XIV did everything he could to keep this story under wraps. And so what I've tried to do in this book is to try to get a sense, and I'm going to close with this, try to get a sense of who these various people are, why they would be involved in these activities, what made it so that women, especially in the 17th century, were very eager to engage in poisoning and specifically reach out. There was an entire word. It was called inheritance powders. And I'm realizing it's almost Thanksgiving time. So we all are going to see our family. So if you need some recipes for inheritance powders, come and see me. But what would make someone so desperate with their situation as to want to reach for inheritance powders? And then also, what is the journey that a person would need to take from being somebody who, to my mind, was really ethical, moral, upstanding, and to take him to that point where he is ready, willing, and able to enact some of the most painful, painful tortures. So it's a titillating study in a way, because there's lots of sex, there's lots of violence, but it's also, I hope, asking some larger questions about who we are and what we're willing to do and how far we're willing to go. So I think I'll leave it at that and then take some questions.
Questions?
Poisonings. You mentioned poisoning. What were some of the favorite techniques for poisoning people?
Primarily arsenic. Arsenic, there were no tests for arsenic until the late 18th century. Arsenic was perfect. It's odorless, colorless, and tasteless. And there are so many different ways. You could either administer it a lot, and then the person would get bumped off immediately, or you could do it really slowly in a really horrible way, is that the women in particular who were married to men they didn't want to be married to anymore would take their husband's pants and give them to a laundress who knew how to use arsenic, and sprinkle the arsenic right around this part of the man's clothing. And then slowly, what would happen is first there'd be a rash, and then there'd be blisters, and then the man would get sick, and then he would die, and then the widow would say, "Oh, I miss my husband so terribly, but he cheated on me. He had the most horrible sexually transmitted disease, that poor widow." And then there were also really weird things like toads, toad venom, menstrual blood, dried menstrual blood, fingernails. I worked with. I was able to find the some of the documents that were confiscated from Marie Marguerite's mother's home and some of her recipes. Some of these recipes had over 30 ingredients. Did they work? Who knows? But the arsenic certainly worked.
Yeah, back here.
I'm ignorant of this, so I don't know if this only comes about when democracy emerges. But was there a press at that time in 17th century France? Did they pick up on any of these disappearances? Maybe that's not something.
No, that's a really great question. The French press itself, we won't see until much later in the years preceding the French Revolution. And the press has a lot to do with the move towards the revolution. There are some society papers, but they're keeping quite quiet about them, about it. Where I find most of this sort of is through the memoirs. And particularly the salons where people would gather. So there was a lot of informal gossiping that was going on at the time. Mm-hmm. And keep in mind that, I mean, the court was moving in bulk at this time. And so, you know, they would say, did you hear about the Marquis so-and-so? But it's an excellent question. The press doesn't play a role into it and wouldn't until the late 18th century.
Did you have the actual documents? Did you put this together?
Yes, ma'am, I did. Yeah, I spent a lot of time at that library with all of these books. And it's the papers it's really quite moving to have it in hand. It's amazing that they were kept. By the way, the librarians. This is a story for the librarians. The reason why we even have these documents is because of a librarian. When the Bastille was charged in 1789 in the French Revolution. Most of the documents that had not been put away in the archives that were deep into the Bastille prison were set on fire, right? But the revolutionaries didn't get deep, and they didn't get to the earliest records, which were my records. And so once the fires stopped a bit, then a librarian went and he started collecting books that had been abandoned or that risked destruction and began collecting them. And he kept them in the basement of a nearby church. And it's those records that are the ones I worked with and that also form the base of the collection of the Bibliothèque de l'Arsenal. They were at the Bibliothèque de l'Arsenal, which is one of the main early modern libraries in Paris, is formed actually on the Bastille archives. So if it hadn't been for a librarian, this story would never have been able to be told.
Question. Well, I have one because I'm very interested in how these remedies, so to speak, these inheritance powders, some of them sound very similar to things that were developing later on in the New World in places like Haiti and French Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what your take on that is.
Sort of eclectic voodoo spiritual type of stuff? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, keep in mind Louisiana was French for a very long time, and also too there were the native populations, and so you get this odd mix. And I'm not a specialist at all of Louisiana, but you get this odd mix that has its own flavor. But many of the things that we can imagine, you know, sort of in the stereotypical, you know, Louisiana early days voodoo type of thing, that's what my gals were doing. They were casting spells over dried pigeon hearts. They were taking dolls and stabbing dolls with pins. Yes.
So which way did it go across the Atlantic?
I wouldn't be able to say because you know we're in the 17th century and there's lots of New World travel. I think. Early American, like colonial American medicine, was built, of course, on European foundations. And early modern medicine played a huge role in how people understood how poisons worked and actually what the basis of the poisons were, which plants were more poisonous than others. And so I think it'd be hard to say which way, because there's also a very, you know, again, there's the eclectic mix that you have, right, of a variety of populations intersecting down in the Louisiana area and other places in North America. It's a wild world out there. It's a wild world.
Other questions? Back here? I was just curious about the logistics. You said there were 400 or so people arrested, and that the police chief and the police force was still kind of a new thing. So I don't know if you came across in your records or anything. When people were arrested, was it like a large group of police went out and got a lot of people, or was it just a few people kind of quietly taken out of the
population? It depended, I think, on the specific cases. For smaller suspects, they would just nab them off the streets. For more prominent nobility, they would send... Now, keep in mind, there was the new police force, but the king had his soldiers, right? And he had his musketeers, right? So for the more prominent cases, he would send his musketeers out. And I saw it when I was talking about the Count of Monte Cristo. Do we have other readers? Like, three musketeers out there? Yeah? D'Artagnan?
Yes.
That's one of Louis XIV's real live guys, right? And he doesn't really show up. I didn't include him in the book, but he does show up in the records from time to time of arresting people.
Following on his question a little bit, you mentioned earlier that torture stuff was post-conviction torture. What was the state of procedural law?
What a great question. What was the state of procedural law in this age of torture? There were clear procedures. The Parliament, the French Parliament, which is the main legal body, not the political body, the legal body, had a variety of rules, and they actually had just about 10 years before this case began to codify the situations under which torture was permissible and not. You start to see more doctors being present in the torture chambers. And at first I thought, well, that's a good thing, is to protect... It was to make sure that they would take the criminal just to the point of death, because they didn't want to kill the person. They wanted to make sure that they could execute them the next day. Lovely, right? This case is interesting because any procedure that one might imagine in French law was unilaterally dismissed. The secret court, the prisoners did not have any legal representation. The very fact that some of those people, all of those people who died painfully on those islands, were brought to trial. We're at the moment of the Wild West of legal precedents.
Does that include, for instance, these post-conviction tortures were random?
No, so they're post-conviction, right? And so depending on what the eventual punishment was going to be and how much information they still thought that they could get from the convicted person, then they would impose the torture. And they had different levels of torture. They had the ordinary torture, which would mean in this case you just get it on one leg. And then they had the extraordinary torture where you get it on both legs. Didn't seem to be really any rhyme or reason many times.
Like the 80th waterboarding.
Yeah. Well, they didn't water... There were a few prisoners that they wanted to do the water torture on, which what they would do is they wouldn't dunk you, they'd fill you so full of water that you would suffocate yourself through the water. Interestingly, they tried to do it, they were going to do it for a couple of Marie-Marguerite's mother's co-workers, if you will, but one of them looked at it and they said, she's really too fat to do this. So they decided that they were going to do the boot torture. And another one is they were going to do it, and the water buckets had frozen at the Bastille. There's no rhyme or reason, but the tortures happened post-conviction. So many of these people on the island were not tortured per se, but I would say I would not want to be living my life on that island and dying painfully. I can get the death dates on some of the people who died on those islands. Many of them I can't. They just disappear from the record. They're gone.
Anyone else? Well, with that, we want to especially
thank you for having me.
A little token of our appreciation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now it's time for our door prize. We're going to give a copy of
all the slips.